Welcome to episode one of Terrifying Vorpal Tales, the podcast. We're your hosts, Tyler, Sean, and today, Dwayne. Yay. In this episode, we're talking about Carcosa, cosmic horror, and how it relates to RPGs. So buckle up, because it's about to get creepy.
From the home office in Sioux City, Iowa, we are talking about Carcosa and cosmic horror and how they connect to RPGs.
Dwayne was going to tell us all about how Carcosa is a real place.
Oh, Carcosa is a real place. Ooh. And if you join me on this adventure, I can tell you how to get there. It's only going to cost your soul and maybe a couple other people's, but it's a wonderful vacation spot.
Yes. Can't tell if he's serious or not.
So tell us, Dwayne, about Carcosa. Where is it? It's real?
No. And you know what? I wish it was, because that would make it even more cool.
I was just hoping it was like a place in the middle of South Dakota that just happens to be named it. And there's like a post office, a gas station, and whatever.
Right. Like there's a Hell, Michigan. Exactly.
Right. Exactly. Or like Climax, Georgia. Something like that. But
Climax, Georgia?
Yes, yeah, there is.
Climax, Georgia. My friends in college drove to it one day and then found out that it literally was just a gas station and a diner. And they were like, hey, it's like March, right? Isn't Mardi Gras going on? And then they just shot down to Louisiana and stayed the week. So
sounds like a fun trip. Carcosa exists only in the imagination of Ambrose Bierce, who wrote An Inhabitant of Carcosa in 1886.
Correct.
Yes. The city is actually only described in hindsight in the original story by a character in the story who lived there. Origins are nebulous. There was a city in France called Carcassonne in medieval times. Could have been just a play on that.
Right. Okay.
But then Robert W. Chambers, borrowed it for his stories. His story is The King in Yellow. In 1895, the height of Victorian era. So this ranks up there with Dracula and Frankenstein for classics.
Yes, but then it was used yet another time.
Do tell.
It is also referenced in the Cthulhu Mythos stories of H.P. Lovecraft and the authors who followed him.
H.P. Lovecraft wrote poetry about it, which is appropriate since a lot of French stories were written in poetry style in Victorian England.
Did he mean to copy that, or was that just like happenstance?
Ambrose Bierce was one of his favorite authors as a reader.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
Yep. He actually put his in a specific location in the star cluster Hyades. But he never specifies if that's in this galaxy or another. You can never tell with Lovecraft.
Best guess, it's somewhere, you know.
Somewhere terrible.
Right. Just it's like gas station, diner, and then just like tentacles everywhere. Just, yeah.
Correct. Lovecraft himself didn't actually make any serious connections with any great old ones or entities in his writings, but his whatever the word for who comes after, post-assessors, it did. They're the ones who connected Haster directly to the legend.
Oh, wait, what do you mean that he didn't write any old one? Like, what does that mean?
It wasn't, like, specific to Haster, The King in Yellow.
Oh, okay, got it.
Right. The King in Yellow was an idea that the original author came up with. Lovecraft mentioned it, but didn't really elaborate. Later authors in the mythos elaborated it to specifically be Haster.
Haster just the thing, and then they connected it to the King in Yellow, or was like, well, that
King in Yellow is Haster.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Like,
right, they connected the god to the name in the poem.
Okay, got it. Cool.
Yeah, Haster's only actually specifically mentioned by Lovecraft in The Whisperer in Darkness.
Ah, okay.
I'm gonna have
the
to
mythos has
that again.
Fully elaborated him, given him a daddy. In relationship to the other gods, he is the offspring of Yog-Sothoth, opener of the way.
Hmm. How do you know all this stuff?
I'm sure some of my facts are slightly off because my brain is fuzzy today, but yeah, I am a connoisseur of the mythos. Not necessarily of the man, because he sucked a little, but the mythos, for sure.
So, like, when was the first time you heard about the King in Yellow or Carcosa or... Did you read the poem or did you?
I read the story first that Lovecraft wrote and then looked up where it came from and found the actual original tale and read that.
Oh, cool.
the first time that I actually heard about the King in Yellow was in some weird movie. Like, it was a really bad movie that I had watched randomly somewhere, and I was like, what is this? And then I started, diving, I Googled it, I dove deeper, and then I was like, oh, okay. And then it just spawned stuff that I was already reading.
I think I remember reading I remember reading a lot of Lovecraft stories as a kid, just randomly, not even know what I was reading. And then kind of forgot all that existed. And then D&D came out with a book that kind of referenced the worm wizard, or it was the worm that walks or something like that, which is kind of a reference. Yeah. So, and then that sort of stretches off from that. And then I want to say it wasn't really reseeded in my mind until HBO did True Detective and used the references for that, which I think that then put it in everybody's mind. So
I actually have not watched that.
It's good. Don't talk to Steve about it, but it's good.
Yeah. I'll withhold comment on future seasons, but season one's good. Even though nothing supernatural ever happens, it's still cool.
Right. Yeah.
It's still a really good just murder mystery.
Right. It's one of those things. We're going to say a lot of weird shit, but there's murder mystery going on. So, have fun.
Yeah. A lot of the artwork does describe him as just being writhing tentacles in a yellow robe with a mask. Worm-like is very apt. As for why that matters is why are we interested in Carcosa, boys?
Why are we interested in Carcosa?
Well,
multiple reasons.
Allow me to retort. So currently we are in our second season of Strange Aeons, the adventure path from Paizo or Pathfinder.
I have to interrupt here and say the greatest single campaign ever written.
I am truly enjoying it. I am running it and I wish I was playing it. But in this campaign, which is broken up into, how many?
Five?
No, 1, 2, 3, 4, six
books. Yes, old school.
Different books. Yes, it is a long adventure path.
This is a Pathfinder 1 adventure path for those listening, but we've converted it to 2e. Carry on, Dwayne.
As your characters move throughout the world, you don't actually interact with Carcosa until the very last book. But in the Pathfinder genre, Carcosa is a living alien city. Again, like Tyler said earlier, it's located on a highly magical planet in some solar system. And it is home to the great old one, Haster, who is the Yellow King. And the planet itself is kind of like, the city itself is like a visage of multiple different cities in a weird patchwork kind of material planish nexus, if that makes any sense.
It consumes cities from other worlds and makes them part of itself by absorbing them. It's how it feeds.
There you go.
So in the adventure path, ultimately your goal is to save your town or the one you become connected to from being absorbed.
Say it so much better than I do.
It's a cool module too, because they have a lot of Lovecraftian mythos style beasties.
Yes.
Some classics and some unique ones you can only really find in Pathfinder.
For those who are interested, the current cities that have already been consumed by Carcosa is the city dubbed Nuruzavin, as Lanti, Bulvari.
I think that's
which
right.
The ruins of an elder thing.
Wait, like
An elder thing city. Sorry.
Oh, but like you're just walking.
Yeah, it's just a dead elder thing you walk on top.
Pathfinder loves its mythos, and a lot of its ancient regions are like serpent men and old Conan style elder beings used to rule the world.
There is an interesting section of a city called Peri from some strange planet called Earth. Yep. There is a hazy reflection of the town of Thrushmoor, which currently our adventurers are in the second book, the Thrushmoor Terror. There is an underwater city, mainly filled with undead remnants of its former citizens, and one technologically advanced city full of skyscrapers, robots, aliens, and non-native creatures with guns.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, as I understand it, they were going to write a companion module for Starfinder, but it hasn't happened yet. Still might, though.
Oh, got it. Cool.
I'm sure you could write it in fairly easily.
Yeah. Also, we, Carcosa being such a flexible thing, we're also using it for one of our books that's going to be released in a few weeks here. Our Vorpal Tales supplements for role-playing for Chaosium under the Miskatonic Repository banner. We both played and then are converting an adventure that I wrote called The Lurking Silence, which takes the idea of Carcosa and the idea of Silent Hill and merges them into one terrifying story. You might call it a terrifying tale.
Oh.
Yes.
Set on a remote island in the remote part of Lake Michigan. Basically its own ocean. The denizens of the island are slowly being sucked into a halfway world, halfway between the real world and Carcosa, as the emotional drama playing out reflects the King in Yellow play until ultimately the whole island is absorbed, or at least its inhabitants are, unless the player characters can stop the evil fate. We took the idea of the French demi-monde, which is referenced heavily in the King in Yellow play, which was the idea of the half world, but it was a cultural thing in France in Victorian era. It was a way to express your hedonism and all the naughty things one shouldn't do that were not prim and proper, but still maintain your normal visible public life. So you could go out and find some saucy gentlemen and have yourself some naughty sex, but then still be a proper and prim gentleman in daily life without anyone necessarily being any the wiser. So we took the demimonde and made that our half world. So like in Silent Hill style, you got the overworld where everything's trapped in fog, but it's still the real world. And then when whatever happens, depending on your choice of game or movie, you slip into the super dark, corrupt world with the crazy monsters. That's our demimonde.
Or is it the other way around?
That's part of the mystery. It was a very good lesson for anyone who wants to check out Vorpal Tales on YouTube, a very good lesson in exactly what happens if the players do everything in the exact wrong order. And I planned for it, so I let it happen. Instead of investigating first and then finding the evil occult idol and being able to defend against its properties, they went after the idol first and were overwhelmed by it and then investigated what they should have done, but it was too late because most of them were insane. That adventure ended with, I think, one character surviving, ended up in a madhouse anyways. Everyone else was dragged into the demimonde forever or died. One of them became the avatar of Haster on the island, the Queen in Yellow.
Ah. I remember that ending now. I was not playing in that game, but I was listening on it.
It's a great story. It worked out pretty well. The adventure we're writing, though, incorporates some of them as NPCs, but it resets it like it never actually happened because they prevented the fate of the island. But yeah, you have to prevent the citizens of the island from being absorbed by Carcosa and you yourself. The idea of the city absorbing other cities to feed and to grow seems to be the common prevalent idea most people latch onto for Carcosa in RPG fiction.
I always pictured it as this strange isle and mist in some swampy location.
It is in the lake, yeah. It's supposed to be in a lake called Halley. So, speaking of cosmic horror, seems to be a big thing these days. We've noticed a trend of it becoming increasingly popular.
Yeah, it's like we went from zombies to cosmic horror.
Yeah.
That weird transit, like zeitgeist transition.
Vampires in the aughts, zombies in the teens, and now we're transitioning to cosmic horror.
I wonder why that is.
Vampires and zombies is usually political. When the Republicans are in power, everyone loves zombies. When the Democrats are in power, everyone loves vampires. I think you can make that connection in your head to why. Republicans, everybody has to fall in line and obey the rules, and Democrats, they want your money. Spread it out to other people. At least that's the subconscious reaction to said thing. Hmm. Bloodsuckers and brainless automatons.
Ah, now I get it.
Yeah. Dwayne's like, aha.
The wheels are turning.
I mean, thinking about just what's happened in the world in the last 4 or 5 years, and then definitely within the last year, like, there was a moment every day of waking up to an existential dread, which then like I don't know about anybody else, but you sort of evaluate your place in the cosmos and go, oh, I am worthless. Cool.
That is, I think that is part of it. Another part is probably the mythos revolves a lot around two things. One, uncontrolled chaotic change that you're helpless to do anything about. That definitely describes the last few years. And xenophobia and the world turning towards nationalism and internalizing.
Yeah.
Is Lovecraft, you know, it's, you can debate or not debate. We're not going to get into that as a show. What you think about people of a certain time period, how responsible they are for their behavior. But it's one thing to say everybody thought a certain way, and another thing to look at Lovecraft, who was extreme even for his time. So the mindset is in the stories. He was very xenophobic and very racist.
I always love, like, if you listen to Robert Evans on Behind the Bastards, he talks about those time periods of, like, everyone was racist. There was just various levels of it. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. And yeah, I think that's part of it. Also, it's really been on the rise since he died. Lovecraft died poor. Because it's not even necessarily because no one noticed him. It's because he was so extremely picky about his own writing and who he would let publish his stuff. The amount of personal letters and critiques he wrote is five times the stories he wrote. He wrote thousands of pages of letters and stuff to people.
That is insane.
But his actual fiction was what we have. But when his proteges and friends carried forward, even in the 50s, it exploded. And then it had another explosion in the 70s. There's actually quite a few Lovecraft-inspired and direct Lovecraft movies from the 70s.
There's also a lot of songs talk about it, too. I want to say, like, Pink Floyd or something like that. I know they were big in The Hobbit, but there's also some Cthulhu references and some 70s songs.
Some rock bands started showing up around that period too, with, you know, names like Azathoth. What was the guy from Quantum Leap, the scientist? The actor who played the scientist.
Oh,
cigar smoking guy.
The guy from Dunwich Horror.
Yep, that's why I was bringing it up.
Sam.
No, it's Dean, not Dean Cain. No, maybe it is Dean Cain. No, it's not Dean Cain. Dean Cain's Superman. Dean Stockwell.
Dean Stockwell. There you go.
Yes. Dean Stockwell was in one of the actual, for the time, one of the best Lovecraft versions, which was the Dunwich Horror, the original. The modern one is garbage. And he's in it. It's a cameo. But the original, where he was the star, was really good. It wasn't the full, they didn't do the story the way the book did, but it was still a really good movie for the time.
Cool. I have yet to see that version.
I think I can hook you up.
No, I feel like mythos, Lovecraftian stuff has kind of hit the mainstream now because you had the HBO show. Like, you've seen a lot more movies definitely deal with it. What was that? God, what's that? Those three, the series of movies, not The Outsiders,
You're talking about the existential horror ones that I introduced you to.
What was
The Endless and
Resolution.
Yep.
And then there's the Netflix one, which is it's kind of a monster movie, more like a Lovecraft. Not The Void. The Void's awesome. The Void's great. That's definitely a great movie. That's like full on, but it's the one, The Ritual, where they go in the woods and there's a weird woods monster. Yeah,
I don't know if I would consider that cosmic horror.
Which one? The one with the Norse monster, right?
Yeah, the one with the Norse monster.
Because there are two main aspects to mythos. One is the cosmic horror and the existential crisis. The other is uncontrollable madness. And that's definitely what happened in that movie. The main character started going mad from the liquor store on.
And then what happens when you decide to, like, give into that thing and what living forever means? Yeah, that's totally some cosmic horror level stuff there. That's But I don't want to be cynical, but I feel like vampires, the mass media just played them out. Zombies got played out. So it was just like marketeers going, what's the next weird thing we can throw at people so we get cosmic horror?
Now, it also helps that there's a movement now to reclaim the mythos away from its grosser aspects. So, like, it's open now, not just to xenophobic white people, but also the HBO show, for instance, is pure Lovecraft from the perspective of black people.
Yeah. Lovecraft Country. That's
Lovecraft Country. Yeah. And there's other media representation of it too. So it's got a broader audience now.
I think too, like
picking it up too, like Onyx Path adding it to Scion.
I think too, because, you know, a lot of times when people think of mythos and, you know, Lovecraft and, you know, cosmic horror, that they're always thinking of, you know, the creepy monsters and the tentacles and of course, you know, the madness and all that. But I think why people are starting to like it more is it's more homely, like, you know, apart from, you know, vampires and zombies, it's not something that a lot of people can relate with. But then you look at a movie like A Cure for Wellness, which didn't have a whole lot in it, but it definitely did have some Lovecraftian overtones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that type of situation, being in a psych ward.
Yeah, Get Out.
Yeah,
had mythos overtones.
Oh yeah.
Oh totally. Yeah, that was a good one. I really liked that movie.
It's that moment of like you're in a situation and you're either going to go mad because of that situation or you can just choose to find a way out and like fight like hell.
Die.
and you usually will die, but it's like, and that's sort of the, I don't want to say consequence of the choice, but that's just, it shows how futile your choice is. Like you can either go mad and be mad and just not know that you're mad and exist in oblivion, or you can fight against it and you're going to die because you can't fight the inevitable, for lack of a better term, or you just can't fight it because it's beyond your ability to fight it or even comprehend it in most cases. So,
and like you said earlier, it puts your worth in the cosmos.
Yes.
Into perspective, like, oh, well, you know, no matter what I do, it's not going to matter because I am but one speck.
Right. I think as our world has opened up and gotten more connected and we learn more about, you know, the systems that we're in and how those systems are built and how little choice we have about those systems and fixing them. I mean, just waking up every morning is a minor bit of cosmic horror of just going, I exist to go to a shitty job that exists because somebody's getting paid millions and isn't paying me. And like, you know, you just get in this cycle of like, well, I exist and I'm trying to find the few bits of happiness. And then you have your own little strange little bit of madness of just, you exist in this weird cycle that you're in, the of misery and brief happiness.
The farther science advances, the more we realize how vast the universe is, and it becomes like, they tell you that, sure, but it's tangible now. You can see it and read about it and hear it. And like, not just that, but then we also learn, we don't know shit. Every time we discover something new, we got to restart physics.
Right. And it's,
we are helpless in the face of a vast, uncaring blackness.
Yeah. Like you learn what the atom is like 20 years ago. And it's like, just these three things. And then now it's like 14 different levels of different types of entities that are just wavelengths upon wavelengths. And you're just like, oh, it just goes into oblivion and there's no end to it. And what I once knew doesn't mean anything anymore. And what I do know now just shows me that it's just going to keep going and I have no control over it, and that I just exist because wavelengths somehow, somewhere.
I also like Fermi's paradox. Everybody's heard that, right?
Is it, which one's that? Is that
That's the one that explains why we haven't contacted aliens.
Everyone's
always heard there aren't any but us because of the vast scale of time it takes for to create life. Hundreds of thousands of millions and billions of years, or either too late or too early. That's the one everyone's heard.
Or just they might have also heard life is.
Yeah, the sheer amount of time it takes to create it. It's just, there aren't any others within range because we're too soon or too late. And then also people have heard there's second Fermi paradox where life's out there, but it isn't intelligent yet. We're the farthest ahead. Most people haven't heard of the third one though, that they are out there, but they're being fucking quiet because there's something terrifying that comes for you if you start calling out.
Mm.
That's very Lovecraftian too.
Yeah.
That's something scary out there that they're all hiding from, saying, turn your damn radios off, humans.
Stop it. Stop that. Turn it off. Turn off the TV. God damn it. Just I'll go back and live in caves.
Wow. I mean, I actually have not heard that third one. So that, I mean, even for me, that puts a whole new perspective on stuff.
That one's creepy. Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah. You know, yeah. We're doing all this stuff, trying to send out signals to be like, hey, come visit us. We're cool too.
It's and actually called thing, you know, the green eyes and tentacle monsters are hovering over your planet. And it's like, right. Oh
yeah,
that was a bad idea.
It's actually called the zoo hypothesis. It has three parts to it. One being the one I said, but there's two others where we're too primitive to bother talking to is one possibility. Mm-hmm. And the third one like was
the aliens were too alien for us.
Yeah, basically
we're too primitive. Yeah, we're still got nukes aimed at each other, for instance.
Yeah. Or there's the one where like we're kind of like the Men in Black thing, where like we're just marbles and our galaxy, our existence is just we're in a locker somewhere.
There's also one where the advanced civilizations, knowing the cosmic scale it takes for life to happen, put themselves into stasis waiting for life to happen, and they're all still sleeping. The third version is the one I said, where there's extremely violent intergalactic colonizers that will come for you if they know you're there, which is, you know, what humans would end up being, probably.
Probably. Just scum of the fucking universe.
Yeah, there's other Pathfinder paths, too, you may catch Vorpal Tales doing in the future. Relating to Lovecraftian stories. There's full campaigns like we're doing and adventure paths. Their newest one in Pathfinder 2e is called the Abomination Vaults, and you're going deep into their version of the Underdark, and all of their motifs are tentacled. I haven't actually read it yet, though.
I have not.
It's the Underdark, so you know. That's where not mind flayers are. And not beholders.
Yes.
Not beholders.
Not beholders.
Wait, are those...
One of those two is copyrighted by Wizards of the Coast. I can't remember
which. Oh, no shit. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I think it's Mind Flayer.
I think it's Mind Flayer, yeah.
So Illithids or whatever they are.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And I mean, even using the open game license, you don't get to use that word?
Correct. It's like the proprietary parts of the player's handbook you're not allowed to share, yeah.
Oh, no shit. Didn't know that.
There's cool. A few other monsters like that, too, but I can never remember the full list.
Probably like the Tarrasque or whatever.
Oh, Tarrasque is public because that word has existed for a long time in the real world.
No shit.
Yeah. Huh.
Cool.
I lost Owlbear. Owlbear might be. It's a lot of the ones where they made up words where Gygax didn't come up with his own thing.
Now, Owlbear's in World of Warcraft, so I don't think that would be one.
It's true.
Or else somebody's about to get sued.
Or they bought the permission to use could the word. Been. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah. We lean pretty heavily on cosmic horror on our Sunday show, too, which is actually called Tales of Terror and Damnation. A lot of existential madness happens on that show. Delta Green, that's a great game where you're basically destined to die in a blaze of glory fighting Cthulhu monsters. There's Pulp Cthulhu, which is like Call of Cthulhu, but less helpless. Last time we did a Pulp Cthulhu adventure that you can catch on our YouTube. Was it Rachel or Steve's character? I can't remember which of them. Drove a car into a greater Shoggoth and blew it up. Can't do that in regular Call of Cthulhu 7th edition. You could, but you'd probably die.
Right. Man, well, that was... I can't remember now. Anyway.
I think it was Rachel.
It was Rachel. Sounds right. Yep. Travis actually walked up and punched the monster. He died, but he still walked up and hurt it by punching it. We do Call of Cthulhu 7th edition. There's a lot of properties out there now. There are so many mythos-based TTRPGs. I think that explains part of the renewed interest in the Alien franchise, too.
Probably
pretty,
so,
pretty yeah. Helpless against the Xenomorphs.
Yeah, I've been thinking about... I've been trying to write the same story over and over again to just sort of refine it. But, like, I think I'm at... Even if you are, like, a super-powered super being, like, the inevitability of... whatever dark forces are in the depths of the universe, like your inability with all the power and might in the world to fight against that, and just like eventually it will come and all you can do is just sort of retreat and survive as long as possible.
One of the greatest mythos books I've ever read, it's right here, it's called Cthulhu's Reign, edited by Daryl Schweitzer. It's a collection of short stories, every single one of which the old ones returned. What would happen when the inevitable happens? And there are 14, 15 short stories about what happens when the Elder Gods return. The Cthulhu one is especially fascinating because it's aspects of him that you don't see in the books. Like, he can be any size he wants, and he can bi-locate and co-locate. Ah. He's a god. So he's like, the whole story is the people running away from him just to run to him because he's in more than one place at a time.
That's slightly terrifying.
Yeah.
While we're on the whole, you know, talking about aliens and space and, you know, things coming for us, I immediately thought of something that might have triggered unconsciously people's love for cosmic horror. Mass Effect.
Yeah, Mass Effect is definitely, even the first one.
Once you hit the scale of the Reapers.
Yeah, yeah, once
you realize that the second game, you're like, mass.
Yeah.
Giant tentacly things are coming for us.
You might be onto something there, that Mass Effect actually triggered something and just everybody was like, oh, zombies are dumb. Let's move on to these weird tentacly things in space.
Even the first game at the end, when you actually get on their ship and there's just hundreds of them.
Yeah, or
that's like a defining video game moment for me. Like, the first time a video game, the odds were overwhelming.
Oh. Yeah.
But you mean the end of the third game where dies?
No, the end of the first one where you're alone on the ship at the end, not the very end of the game, but you end up on the alien ship and there's like, at the time they only threw 5 or 10 bad guys at you at a time and there's like 50 of them in a large area.
Yeah, and when you go from the first one with Sovereign and then you realize that there's just more of them and they're just endless, and then they're just going to come for you no matter what. And the whole thing where like Shepard may or may not have saved the world and it might just be a hallucination and we all did die. Like, the ending has some like branches where you're like, oh, that's dark no matter what happens.
Okay. Or just put off the inevitability for another millennia.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very Lovecraftian too. You're just postponing it.
And I know it was one of those things, like the ending gives you, or the beginning gives you such hope. And then I don't know what the writers were going through where they just went down a tunnel and just into that dark space. And you're like, this isn't the space opera I thought I was playing. And this makes me uncomfortable and unhappy. Let me internet post.
Definitely Del Toro has encouraged the reawakening of the mythos thing too. Stephen King is a massive fan of the mythos, and it's actually in the majority of his books, and he's written, that I can think of, 5 short stories specifically about it,
which is funny because Stephen King books have always been huge and everybody loves those things, but like, nobody made that connection, or nobody was talking about the...
I know, and he actually says it in the book.
Yeah, which is so strange. Yeah, it's weird that it is so prevalent nowadays, and not just like in nerd circles or anything. Like, everybody knows what fucking Cthulhu is. HBO decided to make a special on it. Like, you know, it's out there. Everybody knows what it is now, and that's only recent. That's not something that, so yeah, that's really, really weird that it just kind of like, hey, it's a thing now.
You all subconsciously know.
Maybe
he is awakening.
Yeah, maybe that's the thing. Slumber. I always picture little baby Cthulhu just kind of rolling restlessly, and Ryla just like, nah.
You're in trouble if that's true, Sean, because it's the artists who suffer the worst when he starts to awaken.
That's okay. I'll make some really cool shit before I drill my brain hole out or something.
When this is probably off topic, but again, more questions come to my mind than answers when we talk about cosmic horror.
Welcome to cosmic horror.
So, I mean, you know, Cthulhu and the mythos has been a thing for a while. We've already established that. But when did it get popular again? Like, was it like 2005, 2006? Like, when did I start seeing beanie babies of Cthulhu running around? Like,
oh, that was early teens, 2012-ish, that really started blowing up. Well, okay, so that makes sense. 2012, think about that.
What happened in 2012? I don't even remember what happened in
the Mayan calendar.
Oh, yeah. It
was supposed to be Doomsday.
You know, I'm gonna go with Mass Effect 2 came out in 2010, so I'm going to say 2010. is when this became.
But yeah, it was around the time we went from the aughts to the teens.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That really makes a lot more sense now.
We all, you know, fell out of favor with the boy bands, and then suddenly we were less listlessly in the wind and started contemplating our own existence.
The idea of the power of the collective unconscious is scientifically proven. It's not esoteric anymore. It's definitely a thing. And when you, it's fun to trace connections like this to it.
Plus, that's too, like, when, you know, the Iraq war, like that whole war on terror, like we realized that, oh, it is just all just, you know, kind tentacles. Of a garbage. It is all industrial complex tentacles. Just, yeah. Mm. It's all just garbage. Like our whole existence is garbage.
Hydra and the specter that is real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So welcome everybody to our game of 6 degrees to Cthulhu.
Right. I mean, that's actually a pretty, I mean, I don't know if anybody's done the research on it, but that would be one of those things. Cause like Tyler said, that it is a known thing about the vampires and zombies are popular. And there has been a twist and a turn in the cultural zeitgeist a lot lately where like, vampires and zombies don't explain our existence anymore because we have learned so much. So it would be an interesting thing to sort of track that as far back as you could to see when things started hitting culturally inside of media. Cause that would be pretty
good. That would be a fun anthropological thesis. Yeah. For a graduate student.
Yeah. That'd be awesome to know and awesome to track.
Yeah. Make sure that you mention our names.
Yeah. You heard it here first. We gave you our idea. I just want like a dollar, you know, so.
I just want you to promote us.
Or that too. Yeah. I want a dollar and promote me. How's that?
On that note, though, I think that's a good time to say we've had a good scary tale ending to our discussion this episode, though. Wouldn't you gentlemen agree?
I would. Yeah.
I don't feel great if that's what you're asking.
To our listeners, though, we'd like to thank you. Or listening to us creep it real when we were talking about cosmic horror and the Cthulhu mythos. Don't forget to check out The Lurking Silence on our YouTube archive, all of our cool mythos-based games, and The Lurking Silence coming to a drive-through RPG near you soon. And Strange Aeon Season 2, run by Duane, right now on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
Yes.
Next episode on our show, we'll be discussing the terror that is the ocean, Sean's worst nightmare. So until then,
say about that.
So until then, Snickersnacks, stay scary, but don't be a jerk-o-lantern. All right.
I hate everything you just said.